And now we continue immediately to our next speaker, who will be Jan Öberg, Director for the Transnational Foundation for Peace and Future Research.
I'm not taking the floor.
Please, Jan.
Thank you very much. Salaam alaikum to those of you who might be from that part of the world. Debate is the life nerve of democracy. And I think it's marvelous that you people have taken the initiative to have this hearing with witnesses of such dignity and knowledge. I'm thinking of the rest. Coming after the staged hearing of the government, I would like to express my gratitude to the whistleblowers of the world, all doing what Daniel Ellsberg did, probably the most important single human act to stop the Vietnam War. But then came, in this case, Catherine Gunn, von Sponeck, Ray McGovern, Richard Clark, David Kelly, and Karen Kwiatkowski. It confirms my belief that every human being can be a peace movement or a movement for decency. I would wish that there were equally many dissidents among leftist intellectuals, including in the Nordic societies. And I do pay my great respect to Frank Greville and hope that April 14 and 15 will be the change of the debate about the terrible catastrophe that we have been involved in Iraq. It is time to have a serious debate. It is time to base it on facts. And it's time at one point to apologize for what we've done. My background for speaking about Iraq is that I'm no expert. Well, I am, but not in Iraq. I have about 30 years of experience in conflict analysis. And I have spent only 2 times 2 weeks in Iraq, interviewing somewhere between 150 and 200 people, from Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz in 3 hours, over Ba'ath Party members, over parliamentarians, Kurds and others, dissidents, students, intellectuals, journalists, and people in cafes and bazaars and street who were at least not afraid to speak with us when we were there, a little team from the Transnational Foundation, of which I'm the director. And I'm surprised that I may be among those few who spent that long time not being employed in Iraq within the last 2 years before the war. Where were the other intellectuals who went to Sarajevo? They forgot to go to Serbia, they forgot to go to Kosovo, they forgot to go to Baghdad. Some should have been there and known for themselves and experienced for themselves how incredibly big the gap is between the reality on the ground and the mainstream picture presented to us back home here, sitting here. Some of us do not even recognize the country that they are writing about up to the war. My moral standpoint is the following. I have no sympathy for Saddam, and to those who might wonder, he and his government has never paid one single dinar for our missions in the place. I'm saying this with some pride. Not everybody operated that way. I also have no sympathy for the George Bush regime. I do insist on calling it a regime because it's not democratically elected. I do stand on nonviolence, and that the lazy intellectual is the one who advocates violence before even having considered nonviolent possibilities. And my point of departure is not the Danish government or the American government or the Iraqi government. My solidarity was and is and remains with the terribly catastrophe-stricken Iraqi people. Now, having said that, let me just give a little rundown of what it's important to do when you study conflicts. You know, the type of things that the Danish Ministry of Foreign Affairs should have done, but probably have never heard of. Which also is important for politicians who are decision makers and media. One first thing is collect all the information you can as broad as possible about the place you're going to intervene in or deal with. For instance, send somebody there, a delegation, For instance, you're not very well informed when for 12 years you haven't had an embassy in the place. Try to analyze the ABC. ABC is a very simple image, ABC of conflicts. That stands for the attitudes that exist among the participants. Then the behavior, try to see what is it they do, what is it they say, how is it they act. And C, ask yourself what the conflict is about as you see it from the outside and as the parties broadly defined see it from the inside. The parent thesis, never steal the conflict from people. Since they are in the conflict, they also are entitled to live with a solution. Never believe that there are only two parties, there are many. Inside each party, there are many. Never believe that there are any complex international conflicts that can be divided into black and white. It's pretty gray. The few places I've been, I've never seen somebody who was completely white, except civil citizens, who are normally the victims. Remember that we, the international community, so-called, which is about five foreign ministers, but still a term used in international media, there is no community and therefore no international community, is not neutral and never was, it's not mediating, it does not do this without interests, and it is always historically involved in the conflicts where it intervenes. Anybody who knows just have written one page of history of Iraq knows how, for instance, the Brits had their slight problems in 1920, and that Saddam didn't learn how to use gas and bomb civilians from anybody other than the guys in London. Keep communication channels open. Whenever you close down your embassies and your channels, you're fooling yourself. Don't look only at leaders, but look at all society. Look at civilians, look at civil society. Study more than one option. If war is the only plan in town, there's going to be war. Intellectually, it's not very impressive that there was only one plan presented. And don't get carried away by your self-righteousness or by the imagined power of your military weapons. You know, if George W. Bush had less weapons around him, he would be forced to think. And if George W. Bush was a truck driver somewhere in Montana, we would be free of listening to his weird worldviews. None of these basic rules of thumbs that any little course in conflict analysis would teach you were done by the Danish government. It's not done by the Swedish government, it was not done used by the American government. But one of these things, and those of us who went there, obtained no interest whatsoever from decision makers, just saying, come over, tell us what you know. We would have been happy to tell. During the last 12 years where I've been working in the Balkans, I would have been happy to share my knowledge of places where no diplomats had gone and the personalities I'd interviewed. The same in Iraq, no interest, just complicates the positioning that foreign policy now is. Foreign policy is not an intellectual task anymore for Sweden or Denmark, it's a matter of positioning yourself. This war is unique by having been fought in an information black hole. Intelligence was twisted. We had no embassies for a decade or more. And if we had them, such as France or Russia, it was on lower level. The West did not basically have any representations there. We had no contacts, sent no delegations, brought no Iraqis up here, although I happen to know that, for instance, the Iraqi government wanted a dialogue with the European Union. Lack of information, lack of interest, lack of understanding was substituted. That hole was filled with the propaganda, with lies, black and white, false images, make-believe and wishful thinking. Just one example. Why have you not heard one journalist ask the following question to a decision maker about this war? Are you aware, Mr. President, that the combined military expenditures of the United States and Britain is 330 times higher than Iraq's, according to CIA's website? shouldn't have been so difficult to find out. It was not Iraq that stayed in its occupied territories in the Middle East. Iraq had a military expenditures roughly the size, half the size of Sweden. How much can the free society and the free press try to fool us with information that this man was a threat to the world? Come on. Don't trust leaders, as Bob Dylan once said. But watch your parking meters. Therefore, all the domain assumptions on which this war was based turned out to be wrong. There were no weapons of mass destruction at the time. There was no risk to world peace. There was no link to terror. The Iraqis would not welcome the invaders. The chance or opportunity to create better human rights situation in Iraq would not come in the wake of the invasion. I can't help just mentioning that my dear friend Akili al-Hashimi was killed in September last year, member of the governing council because of lack of security, one of the most decent person I met. I can't avoid mentioning Amer al-Sa'adi, the scientific advisor of Saddam, whom I happened to meet in January 2003 for 3 hours in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, who told me that we don't have it. We have made mistakes, we have tried to conceal things, but we don't do it anymore. He was the first to hand himself into the Americans after the fall of the regime, giving an interview to German television saying, "I told you the truth all the time, we had no and we have no weapons of mass destruction." Where is Amir al-Sa'adi today, if he's still alive? In American custody. Where are the human rights organizations? Who knows anything about Hoda Amash, the highest ranking political woman in the Ba'ath Party, whom I also happened to interview and got some sympathy for, if for no other reason that she has consistently in the Western press being called Mrs. Anthrax and her name not mentioned. This is the decency allotted people who comes from an 8,000 years culture in the West. And we were told that sanctions would make life difficult for Saddam. My goodness, what an idiotic thing. If you'd been 3 hours in Iraq, you would know it worked the opposite way. But nobody went to Iraq and saw for themselves. Nobody read UNICEF's reports. I'm glad it has come up today. But we must not forget that this terrible decision made by the Security Council in 91 has led to one of the largest genocides in modern times. They've been in war all the time. And there must be a way in which we pay back and apologize at some point in the future. All the leaders of the UN missions at the time in Baghdad told me and my colleague, and includes also the International Committee of the Red Cross, "We here, sitting here, cannot write political articles, but please, if you can, go home and write two things. That the sanctions is a terrible thing for the people and makes Saddam only stronger. There's no way he can be knocked over because we've destroyed the middle class and the intellectual class in this country. Secondly, if there's a war, everything will be chaos." We did go home and write that. Some listened, some didn't. But we were there before, made up our predictions before. I'll come back to why this is morally and intellectually important to me. When it comes to the media image, I share the view that there are media and media, but let me just say the following. There was far too much focus on Saddam as an individual because of the need for demonizing the person. He was bad enough, so you didn't, no need actually for making him worse than he was. The people were made invisible. I do not recollect Danish or Swedish television having a single program about the culture of Iraq, showing Iraqi films or anything else but footage of military parades, Saddam with weird hats and shooting in the air by one arm or something, macho Nebuchadnezzar-like, well, God knows what he meant by it. There were no human beings living there. How many here knows that 49% of the people in Iraq are kids under 16? And how many knows that the Brits and the Americans had nuclear weapons with them for the eventuality that they would be met with chemical weapons, then they would use nuclear weapons on the Iraqi people? On children under 16. This is the government, this is the thinking with which the Danish government, and I'm ashamed of saying it, and happy that I'm speaking English today, is allied and still insists on continuing this type of barbaric thinking. During the war, I must say, the media coverage was better. I was deeply impressed by the journalists who risked their lives of being embedded. Of course, they could not have freedom to express everything, but we saw things that should have turned us off completely from the war that we have not seen before on television. After, I would have loved to see more journalists not leaving, but staying on and being embedded with Paul Bremer's Coalition Provision Authority, as if the man had any authority. I'd like you to know that the 30 leaders of America who came to the country after the invasion had no credentials, no specific background for doing reconstruction. They came from CIA, they came from the Israeli lobby, they came from the Ministry of Defense, they came from the military industry, they came from Vietnam, they came from all kinds of ugly American institutions. They had no ability to speak Arabic and had no experience prior to it of being in Iraq or doing nation building. Why did the American administration send the most improper people if they loved the Iraqi people and wanted to help them? Now, what are the lessons we could learn? First of all, don't trust your government, particularly not the Danish one. Our government has been more loyal with Washington than with the Danish people. The end station of this could be a terror attack on Denmark. The insecurity, the risk of security to the Danish people is higher today than it was before participating in this. Madrid is a good example of it. If I lived in Denmark, I would not trust or feel very good about the decision-making abilities, the seriousness of providing security for the Danish people after this, including lying to the people, as Frank Reville has so excellently and with great civil courage told us yesterday. And I feel embarrassed when I hear the Prime Minister a couple of weeks ago in Danish television say 8 times or more that we did not go to war because of weapons of mass destruction, but we did it in support of the United Nations. You see, he said, Saddam has violated and not listened to the United Nations, or we can't sit there and accept that the UN is undermined. So therefore, in support of the UN, we did this intervention. I wonder whether that also applies to Serbia or Afghanistan. How much can you get away with saying if you have problems in your private life, or you're drunk driving, or you have affairs or something like that, you can lose your job? I don't bother about things like that, but I bother about thousands of innocent Iraqis being killed in this policy because of the intellectual laziness and the wrong placed loyalties outside Denmark and outside Iraq and the Iraqi people. Saddam was nothing but a product of international arms trade. Stop the arms trade and people like Saddam will not become the ones they are. Forget about neutral mediation. It doesn't exist. When a government moves in because it has interests. Don't believe in the nice motives that are spelled out in press conferences. Reduce your dependence on oil. A good security policy has nothing to do with military anymore. It has to do with an intelligent energy policy and consumption policy. Not the spreading or proliferation of mass destructive weapons is the problem, but the existence of it. As long as somebody keeps on having them and they develop more and more nasty nuclear theories, doctrines, including for use against countries that don't have them. We were in much worse situation than during Reagan's days. As long as they exist, others will try to get them. Proliferation is not the problem. The existence of weapons of mass destruction is a problem. And that's where we should discuss. Not this absolutely low-level media political discussion following in. I mean, if the free media lets George Bush set the intellectual agenda, I'm really concerned. And what about asking ourselves what the European Union could be good for? I mean, it must be good for something. Denmark and Sweden shared the chairmanship in 2002 when mediation initiatives, diplomatic initiatives could have been taken. They were not. If the EU is going to have, which it has so far not had, but if it's going to have a common foreign security policy, let's go for it. Without an army, but with intelligent conflict resolution, preventive diplomacy, meeting facilities, early knowledge about places, diplomatic activities, and outcompete the Americans, because the Americans are actually weak and on their way down as an empire, because the only thing they can is using a hammer. The only reason they do this is they don't have to think. If Denmark had been hit by September 11, we would have been forced to think, because we couldn't have used whatever little weaponry we have to invade this and that country around the world. Just ask yourself, how would we behave if we were hit by what Americans have been hit by? Bad enough, yes, but a tiny thing in the world community. Nothing to get really outraged over. International terrorism is a tiny problem. It's probably way down under number 100 of reasons why people die on Earth today. But we are now producing it. In the struggle against terrorism, we are now producing terrorists on an assembly line basis. Finally, I could say a few things about what I believe should be done in Iraq, because as intellectuals and as deeply concerned people, we must orient ourselves to the future also on the basis of an understanding of what we've done and our own complicity in it. But that is, among other things that I've talked about in this little book of mine that will come out next month here in Danish, particularly written in Danish because I am terribly, I'm probably ashamed of my country. Because I know the image that you came up with from the Gaza Strip about Denmark and Scandinavia, and we have torn this image apart, and it's time the rest of the world knows about it. Those of us who travel a bit in the world have found out how far the image of Norden is from the reality now. So that's in this book, and this book I have called Predictable Fiasco. Foreseeable Fiasco. The reason being that it's easy to be wise afterwards. But I think it's the job of the intellectual to try to look into the future and say, what happens if? And some of us looked into what would happen if we really started this terrible war. And my reason for doing this is that this war will have much larger consequences for the international community, for ourselves. It will be a boomerang. The war on terror as it's fought and the war on Iraq, Afghanistan and Serbia will come back as boomerangs on Western culture. I'm dead scared about the consequences, not of other people's policies, but of our own policies. And the predictability is what makes it so inexcusable. These people could have known, if they cared, that this would lead to a catastrophe, not only for the Iraqi people and for the region, but for ourselves. So this is where I end. I think we need also compensation for the robbery that sanctions have been. And I would like to suggest a long-range reconciliation process. And I'm happy to say one good thing about the Danish Prime Minister. When he became an honorary doctor in the US as a reward for his policies, he made a very good speech. He said that Europe needs a long-range, broad dialogue with the Middle East about reconciliation, economy, cultural cooperation, security, and all that, modeled upon the OSCE, the Organization of Security and Cooperation in Europe, that has done marvelous things for peace in Europe. You know, the Bosnians used to call it the Organization of Seriously Confused Europeans. And it still is, but it's better than most. But then he didn't do anything more about it, as far as I know. The Ministry of Foreign Affairs has not followed up on this. And why did he do this? You know, I believe somehow that people who've done bad things know that they have. I took note of the fact that the Danish Minister of Foreign Affairs, Mr. Stig Møller, was a man who preached in Vedersø Church on New Year's Eve on television. And he said that man was always alone when making big decisions, and it was easier to know afterwards what was right. I could almost hear this man, whom I guess is a humane person and man with decency. We know we have done something wrong. How the hell do we get out of it? I would grant them that much humanity. I don't think that they are brutals. And it's our duty in the peace movement and everywhere else in our dialogues to still dialogue with these people, because we also need reconciliation with those who've done these bad things. But the priority must be the Iraqi people and the people of the Middle East as such. When they have a better life, we have a better life. We have perfect common interests. But increasingly, we do not have a common interest among the people and the leaders in Western so-called democracies. That is our challenge. Spend the money better. The US spends $1 billion a week militarily to be present in Iraq. For $7 billion, less than 2 months' presence, all children in the world could go to school. This is the priorities of this world we're living in, and we are the most guilty in it. Change it.
Thank you, Jan Öberg, for your brilliant and sharp analysis. We are almost running out of time, so we'll have to have quick and precise questions beginning up here. Which of you to start?
Okay, let me start. When you sit in an assembly like this where everybody seems to agree, it's very easy to get the role of the devil's advocate. I must emphasize that I absolutely agree that this war has been and is a disaster. But if we talk about what do we do now, how do we remedy this disaster? I'm very interested in hearing Mr. Jan Öberg, what do you think of Mr. Atwan's position that we should pull out? Let's just pull out and leave it to the Iraqis and they will work it out. I mean, you mentioned something I find very important, that there's never only two parties. There's more than two parties, and there's always more than just blacks and whites. And Iraqis are many things. I mean, between Mr. Muqtada al-Sadr and Mr. Chalabi, there are lots of other gray shades. One of the problems I see is that this Iraqi resistance movement denies any legitimacy to the Iraqis who are working together with the occupation power, those Iraqis who are supposed to represent the Iraqi people. They're considered traitors and legitimate targets, and as you mentioned, some of them have already been killed. Let me also remind that in Afghanistan, the Russians were forced to pull out, and what happened? We had the Talibans, and we had civil war, and a lot of suffering for the Afghan people. So should we just pull out, or do we have a responsibility to stay and try to remedy the mistakes we have been a part of?
Well, I guess that's a $10,000 question or something like that. I do not think that I have an answer, but I think still we have to discuss it. So therefore, my proposal is the following. I see no future. Any day the occupation continues, things get worse. Unfortunately, those who run this show will be the last to see it. I hear no repentance, I hear no openness, I see George Bush living in a kind of autistic world. What we must do is to get these out while some other kind of international benevolent mission comes in. My hunch would be that given the world as it is, the best option is still a huge United Nations mission, aided by the Gulf Cooperation Council, the Arabic League, the OSCE, and whoever else has no blood on their hands. Now, the first argument might be, what should it look like? I would say it should be rather small in terms of military, but a kind of, you know, helping the worst security problems. Rather large on police, and huge when it comes to so-called civil affairs people. It should be the opposite of the normal pyramid in the UN missions. But I say in cooperation with others, particularly regional organizations. Secondly, I would like to see much more people-to-people exchange. I'd like Iraqis to come up here to Europe, cultural people, teachers, engineers, whatever, and we coming down there. Simply get to know these people through working together with them here or there. Human security, human knowledge, human repentance, human reconciliation, human forgiveness. You are human beings, we are human beings. Unfortunately, our governments on both sides did some bad things. I would like to couple that with a large compensation program. We cannot substitute the people who were killed, but we can help the Iraqis in different ways. I'm not saying money only, but at least be sure by international law that no Western company will be able to control Iraq's oil. There must be a provision for that built into it. Compensation must be paid for the sanctions and for the destruction. I know it won't happen, but it must be said. Same goes for Yugoslavia and other places we've destroyed. There is no such thing as a free destruction of countries. So there are many other things. Now, the question, of course, you're raising is the one of which I'm honestly not an expert enough on the Iraqi society to, will it lead to a civil war if we pulled out? I would like a kind of smooth transition from what is withdrawal, tens of thousands of soldiers while others are coming in with a different ticket. I can't give you the answer. I hear some of the most trusted intellectuals that I know in Iraq saying it won't happen, and I hear others saying it will happen. I am afraid, I fear that the consequence of the last year's presence of the United States means that the groups will be pitted against each other. But I can tell you my impression is it was a gross mistake to believe that there were three groups only, that there were three clear groups in Iraq, and that they did not have anything to do with each other or they hated each other. I've had a great fun in all meeting places where we're in offices and ask, well, gentlemen and women, could you please tell us who is a Shiite and who is a Sunni? And they would burst out laughing. It wasn't important to them. Baghdad being the largest Kurd city, 1 million Kurds living in Baghdad. I mean, you know, it's Mosul or Erbil or these places. 250,000 or so Sunnis and Kurds living in the south also. So I can't tell you. I can only say wherever the Americans have been, they have made this DVD at Emperor, either for stupidity reasons or because they wanted to, so that you could pit these groups against each other. It's like Bosnia. There are also allegedly only three groups in Bosnia. I have never met anybody in Bosnia who three generations back in time could say that he was only a Muslim or only a Serb or only a Croat blood. I mean, these are constructions. It's imagiology. It's not even ideology. It's imagiology. It's virtual reality. I don't know, but this is for the risk that civil war might break out. I would like some international presence there, but predominantly civilian. I think 100,000 civilians could do good work in this country together in respect for and in partnership with every Iraqi, wherever they are.
Just a very brief follow-up. When we have this force of 100,000 civilians in place in Iraq, and when the Iraqi resistance groups start attacking them, killing them, and taking hostages, what do we do?
Well, now you make it sound a little bit like this should solve all the problems. I said it was a loose proposal. That's up for anybody's brainstorm. I'm not saying that this will not go bad, but what I do recognize is that the level of violence in the Iraqi society has increased tremendously after the occupation. It was a pretty safe society. Hans has lived there much more than I have. It's a pretty safe society. If I remember correctly, no UN person was ever attacked. Or was it maybe smaller cases or something misunderstood, but there was no real attack on the UN for 12 years where they were administering the sanctions. Now, the UN was killed in Iraq after the occupation. My hope is that the UN would be able to come back. And if that happens, it means military and police. Something like, the Canadians in Eastern Slavonia in the late 90s. Cleaning the place, that might be necessary now because a lot of people have obviously now gotten into Iraq or have started their own little show in Iraq, allegedly fighting the Americans. And they will be a problem the day the Americans are gone. I recognize this problem. I do not have idea about how to do with it. I think the gross violence of the Iraqi society that we see now would disappear more or less, not 100%, but disappear more or less when the occupation leaves. It's mainly directed at Iraqis who are working with the foreigners, mainly. What did you expect me to say?
Next question.
Well, I don't agree with you that Iraq was a safe society, at least not for the Iraqis. But anyhow, I have another question. You said that nobody read the UNICEF reports, nobody went there to see. I think the problem is that we did. We did read the UNICEF report. We did write about them in the newspapers. We did go to Iraq whenever it was possible to get a visa, and that was very difficult as a journalist. Dennis Halliday, Franz Banik resigned in protest. There were plenty of possibilities to know what was going on in Iraq. And nothing changed. For 13 years, this horrific policy of sanction was continued. My question is, why was it not possible to change this policy before? Why should it take 13 years and be a war that changed and lifted the sanctions? And now we've been talking a lot about the states. I would like to ask you about the role of France and Russia in the UN concerning the policy towards Iraq.
Yeah, what do you want to know about it? I'm not an expert on French policy. I'm glad I'm not, by the way. Let me stick with the sanctions also because of the time. I think, you see, the whole thing was constructed wrongly from the beginning. Sanctions could only be lifted, as far as I understand, Hans, you may correct me if I'm wrong, could only be lifted by the Security Council the day there would be a report on the table of the Security Council stating the following: we inspectors have now inspected every corner, every flat, every part of the soil, every river, and we found out that there is nothing. You know, we've even done tests, drilled 300 meters down under the desert sand and found nothing there. Do you think that that would ever have been written? Of course not. It's not the intention. They thought, I believe, I have no proof of that, I think they thought that Iraq would be disarmed within 6 months or so. Secondly, it was virtually disarmed in 1995-96, according to Scott Ritter, who should know. Clinton, and this is important to remember, all this problem is not George Bush. It was Bush and then Clinton and Bush. I mean, there's beating around the bush, but I mean, it's in the middle was a Clinton who refused to lift the sanctions when that report was presented. This was why Scott Ritter got furious and became a dissident, as a good old Reaganite Republican and Marine soldier fighting against the war, because he said, my government is cheating. We've disarmed 95%, 98%, 99% allegedly of what is, and we're still not lifting the sanctions we keep committing on. Intellectually and philosophically, this was a fraud. You cannot give such a report. It would have to, at some point, rest on information, trust and credibility with the regime in Baghdad saying, yes, we don't have any more. You cannot find every little thing in a territory the size of Iraq. So the whole thing was, you know, a mission impossible. I know from my interviews in 2002 with high-level people in Baghdad that they did accept the inspectors to come back under two conditions. And that could have ended it much easier. But the West didn't listen and didn't want the inspectors to come back. Two conditions. One was, we want a timetable. We want to know the day you are leaving and you say you've done your job after 13 years. We've had enough of it. We want a deadline. Tell us when you've investigated everything and every human being and every researcher and every laboratory and every university. That was point one. Point two was, we will not accept any foreign agents as before. We will not have CIA people here. We will not have the information transferred to Israel. Those were the two conditions the chairman of the parliament told me. I have no reason not to believe that were the conditions. Now, Saddam accepted the inspectors coming back. But when the Americans took over Iraq, they would not have UN inspectors coming in. They set up their own team. So they've been much less cooperative than Saddam Hussein has been with the international community. And finally, let me say also, which is so embarrassing and nobody talks about it, who has violated the United Nations at its charter? Saddam has done it 16 times. We've heard that a couple of times. Are you aware that the United States has violated the Security Council resolution 52,000 times? Where? By flying over the non-militarized zone that was set up by the United Nations on the border between Iraq and Kuwait. And where Kuwait and the Americans cut holes a few days before the invasion, and after that, without any proper procedure, saw to it, recommended that the UN was withdrawn from Baghdad, otherwise they would be killed by the invasion. Now, who is violating the United Nations Charter the whole framework of a peace organization of the world. Remember, the first sentence in the UN Charter is that we should lift the scourge of war for succeeding generations. The UN is an organization to create peace with peaceful means, and this is where we are today. It's not the fall of the United States, it's the fall of the rest of us who are not fighting for the UN.
We have time now for only two brief questions, preferably from people having not spoken before. Just two.
Hello, my name is Kasper, and I'm a student. I want to ask Jan Øberg a question. Jan Øberg, you keep saying how important the debate is for democracy. But as a citizen, I get frustrated when our prime minister doesn't show up, doesn't want to debate, and the media is neglecting or forgotten or has forgotten what critical journalism is. How do we create a democratic debate?
Are you okay? Oh, oops. I'm Iraqian, and I'm sorry if I don't speak so good in English. But I'm very sorry that after this Holocaust, the last 14 years, on my people, I still hear the people like Penilla Brahmin and Dorit Salts, which they are the whole time. They justify the sanction, they justify the war on my people, and now they're justifying the occupation by saying the Iraqi people poor, they are children, they need help. We don't need help from occupation. We don't need help from imperialism. We don't need help from fascist Bush and company. The Iraqi people have 7,000 years lived together. And the civil war, which Bush and the journalist which they talk about to justify the occupation of the Iraq, this is nonsense. We have lived together, Shiites and Sunni, Kurd, Arab, Turkmen, Christian, Jewish, and Muslim. Even the Ali Sistani, this is the most religious Shiites in the Iraq. He say, we are secular society. We want democratic state. We live together like a Muslim, like a Jewish, like a Christian. You never hear this from the other part of the world. So this is the civil war, which you make propaganda for to justify the occupation. From where this came? Who have interest in the civil war in the Iraq? It is only the occupation powers.
Okay, I think the panel's speakers, they express the whole problem. I would like to thank especially the conscious persons like Hans von Sponeck and Jan Öberg, Andrei McVorms, of course, my brother Abdel Bari Atwan, which will be attacked from this is so-called civilized democratic media by saying it is a friend of Saddam Hussein. Thank you very much.
Last answers from Jan Öberg.
think that can be quick because I don't believe that democracy is about whether or not the Prime Minister wants to participate in the debate or not. And if he doesn't want, then we will have to debate with other people who want to debate. And this debate is not only in Denmark, it's of course coordinating with a lot of Americans and others who are in trouble. Not necessarily with themselves and their attitudes, but with their governments not following what the people are saying. This is a war where we had the largest pre-war, anti-war demonstrations in human history. And that is a momentum that should be used. But the problem with many of these debates and the peace movement work is that there are very little ideas about how to avoid war and what to do after wars. But there's a massive no to war, no to nuclear weapons, no to everything. But I would like some of these activists and debaters and dialogue people also to address the question with brainstorm techniques and others, what is it we want in the future? How does a better world look? So we have to create it ourselves. There's actually a chapter in my book about the necessity of creating this debate ourselves, create our own media, use the internet, do all these things, and write personal letters to your ministers with fountain pen, nice paper, put it into an envelope, lick a stamp, and go to the post box with it. Don't do email, mass mail. They don't read that. But single letters will reach even the Prime Minister. And it will be reported to him that thousands of Danes are now writing deeply personal letters about their concern. And in all the letters, there happen to be three proposals of how to pull out Denmark from Iraq. That's peace work to me. I believe that every human being is a peace movement, peace worker. But it has to be done by ourselves. Finally, I'm happy and grateful for what you said. And the only reason I talked about the risk of civil war is, and I want to repeat that to make sure we understand each other, is not that I think it will happen or that it was in the cards for the Iraqis. I share the belief that lots of civil wars has been, if not created, then greatly helped by the Western world, including in Bosnia, including arming the extremist Kosovo Albanians, and you see where we are 5 years later, etc. There are interests in the good old, bad old principle of divide et impera. But what I'm saying is it could be the consequence of this many years of sanctions and the occupation, because some bad element, if you will, have come into it. Let me then also just respond to the question about a secure Iraq. By that, I did not mean that it was secure to be a dissident, of course. What I meant was it was fairly secure to walk the streets. It was an orderly society. I had no problems in getting anywhere, any time of the day walking around in Baghdad, speaking freely to people during the 2002 and 2003 visits. But I'm not sure I'm courageous enough to go there. And I have been participating, I'm not participating in wars, but I've been present in a number of war zones in the last 12 years in the Balkans. I'm not sure that this is a moment where I'd like to go back and do training in nonviolence as I used to do with youth groups and women's groups and young men. Because probably it's not a good thing to do it right now. Insecurity, human insecurity in this society is much worse than it's been before. And the causal factor is the occupation. I'm sorry to say, but there's nothing good to be said about the occupation, also for the people who are running it. Mr. Bremer has no background in what he does. He's worked 20 years with the alleged war criminal called Henry Kissinger. And he's a terror, anti-terror expert. And he's been an ambassador. He has no background whatsoever in the Middle East, in nation building, in reconciliation, in conflict, in negotiation strategy, or building schools. If he had, it might have been a benevolent help. But these people are not there to be helpful. Sorry to say so. And this is also why I'm ashamed. They could at least have sent some people who wanted to do something good for the Iraqi people.
There will now be a short break for tea, coffee, water, and I'll have to say we must be back here within 10 minutes. Yes.